part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Chuck and Diane are in the studio, and they're rocking and ready to go. You know, we have quite a ways yet to go before we really are able to get out into the garden and really spend some time in our shirt sleeves, and it's a day many of us are looking forward to, especially given the forecast that we've got for the remainder of the week. So today we're going to do a little daydreaming and dream about the coming of spring and summer. And our guests this afternoon are Chuck Voigt and Diane Noland of the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois. Diane is a teaching associate in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences. She's the host of the WILL TV program, Illinois Gardener, and she is the co-author with Kirsten Bolin of Perennials for the Landscape. Chuck is principal research specialist in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at the U of I. He's the co-author with J.S. Vandermark of Vegetable Gardening in the Midwest. Chuck and Diane can answer our questions about flowers, vegetables, herbs, and more. So if you've got questions, give us a call in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, the number to call. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else outside the local dialing area, if it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks for brightening up the studio this afternoon.
Well, we're glad to be here, aren't we, Chuck?
Yes, we are.
I do want you to know I was out gardening on New Year's
Eve
day.
It was beautiful. I was thinking about the two of you when I was thinking, I wonder if Chuck and Diane are out in the garden.
I actually planted 9 hyacinths that I found that I hadn't planted, so, and mulched them in. I moved some sweet woodruff.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was really a nice day.
Yeah, it was beautiful. Sunny, 64 degrees. We broke a record in Champaign-Urbana.
I cleaned my gutters.
That's exciting.
That's exciting.
I was scooting around on the roof and wore off my knuckle.
Ouch. Well, we have a listener all ready to go in Urbana on line 1. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I just called to find out, what winter hardiness zone are we in now?
We are still zone 5.
I don't think so. Last year and this year.
Because
what happened?
Because you think we are in zone 6 now because of the weather?
It's beginning to head south from there with weather like this. And in seriousness, I called to find out whether you guys have a sense of what, for most gardeners in central Illinois, will be the spring and summer effect of a series of less than our coldest winters.
Well, I know for plant growth, it usually starts the plant growth larger and more robust. The entomology.
Does that make them any more susceptible to the frosts, or are the earliest plants also the cold hardy ones?
In general, the little bulbs are the most cold hardy, the ones that come on early.
It also gets things like daffodils and narcissus up and growing and really sets them up for cold snaps that come seasonably.
Those little broken necks, you mean?
Yes.
That's the one.
Those are the ones.
Mm-hmm.
And
just the see-through, the transparency look of the flowers is from, you know, they grow too quickly. But the secret is to keep a mulch. You want to keep that soil so it's not getting warm and cooling down, and so I was out mulching actually on New Year's Eve day as well. So
you routinely wait until there's actually cold and stable frozen soil before covering it up?
No, I mulch every week of the year.
Do you really?
If I could.
And you don't have rodent problems?
No, I don't. I don't put it right next to a house or a foundation, but I have it, you know, around all the plants. But it does so many things. I feel like I'm teaching class. It keeps the soil really even as far as temperature. It keeps down weeds. It does help to conserve the moisture that we do have in the soil. So I think mulching, aged mulch, not, you know, unaged.
Chuck mentioned little critters. Has there been a pattern of warmer than average winters followed by insect problems?
Well, certainly the insects that are killed by cold winter temperatures are going to be around earlier and or in larger numbers in winters when it doesn't get cold enough to do that. Things like corn earworm, which we can avoid until fairly midsummer to late summer, depending on when a hurricane blows them up from the south, if we have a certain number of days below 32 degrees where the ground is frozen and those kinds of things. If we don't get that, then they overwinter here and we start right away with even the very earliest sweet corn that's susceptible to them. So it depends. Some insects are adapted to here. They overwinter here and, you know, they just kind of celebrate like we do, and it doesn't really affect their numbers because they're going to survive cold or warm. But the things that are killed off by cold are going to be more of a problem after that. I'm not convinced that we aren't going to be cold yet this winter, though.
Oh, we will be.
If it was a question of duration more than the dips. We've really been roller coasting.
Yeah.
I was feeling good about the lowered heating bills, but wondering, as all things, what are we going to pay for later on to get these nice lower bills? Well, thanks for the conversation.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, it was cold at Christmas time. Christmas Eve, Christmas Day. That was a jolt, wasn't it? But it is,
really,
again,
bitter cold.
A roller coaster, as the caller mentioned, you know, from 0 to 64 in a week.
But the down happened a little more gradually, which I was pleased with. It didn't go from 64 to 0 in 24 hours, which it has done at some times. And I think that prepares the plant material for it a little better.
And I think the snow cover, that's really insulating too. So that helped having snow when the temperatures were plummeting. So a lot of times we get more exposed cold weather, and our plants don't do as well as farther north that has more snow cover.
Right. A lot of things are much hardier in the lower peninsula of Michigan, where they get all that lake snow, and they get
They're
covered
protected.
Up and blanketed, where our stuff is out in the bright sunshine with that 15 to 20 degree below with a 30-mile-an-hour wind out of the northwest and really takes a toll.
Yeah, and on the soil as well. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Urbana, line 2. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I have some Techne arborvitae that have been in about 4 years, and I need to know how and when I should feed them and what.
Are they doing well?
The first couple of years, I thought they just sort of survived. Now, last summer, they really did well.
And that was probably a little bit with transplanting, so that's very normal. I wouldn't over-fertilize them at all. I would say maybe a complete fertilizer, even broadcast, maybe once a year, if at all, because arborvitae are so, they're really tough. But just be a nice, where it's a 10-10-10, 12-12-12.
Okay, and when should I put it down?
I would say in spring, wouldn't you, Chuck?
Yeah, probably just before everything starts to grow.
Okay.
And as to amount, it just depends on where you are. If you're in a new development where all the topsoil was scraped away.
I'm inner city.
Yeah, well, if you're in a place where you have fairly native topsoil that's not too disturbed, a lot of woody perennial plants
Need anything.
Yeah, don't need anything. I mean, we have great soil in the northern two-thirds of Illinois, and if we leave it alone when we build houses, we can do great things with it.
Okay.
It's more the moisture.
Oh,
just watch it.
I did find they need a lot of water.
Mm-hmm.
The other question is, I really live almost in downtown Urbana, and I have what a couple of people have keyed down as a tupelo or a black gum.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Every book I've ever read says that this should have flamboyant color. the leaves turn brown and drop off.
Is
and I'm wondering if that needs soil needs amending.
Is it in the shade?
It's pretty much the biggest tree in my yard, but there's a so-so.
So I was thinking shade would cause it to have less fall color.
From seed, they do vary. Mm-hmm. The one over in Illini Grove is probably the best one in town, and they've planted some small ones around that, and they're not nearly as spectacular as the other one.
Tell me where that is. I'm going to go compare because I keep thinking maybe they've misidentified.
It's on Lincoln Avenue.
Right. I know where Illini Grove is. Where in the
just
Grove?
Just past McKinley.
Right. In relation to the little cabin.
It's north and east of the little cabin. It faces right out toward Lincoln Avenue, and it's on that northeast. Corner of Illini Grove, and there's a lot of small ones around it, and the big one. It has a lot of branches. It almost looks like an evergreen branching habit because it has a lot of branches that are on it fairly low to the ground.
Good, because I'll go and compare and see if that's really what I've got.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next, we talk with a listener in Champaign, line 3. Good afternoon.
Hi, is it me?
That's you.
Okay. I just had two questions. One is sort of a tree identification question. This fall, I noticed that there was this one very beautiful type of tree that still retained its red leaves long after all the other trees had dropped theirs. And I do know that in the spring, this tree does have white flowers on it. So I was wondering if it was an ornamental fruit tree of some kind, if anybody would know right off the top of their head what I was talking about right away.
Yes.
The ornamental pears had a really nice fall.
Mm-hmm.
Some falls, if we get too low temperatures too early, the leaves freeze and they don't have time to develop because they color up so late.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had mild temperatures so late into the fall, they had a beautiful season and they do hang on to their leaves late. So there's still a lot of Bradfords around and there are other ornamental pears, but I would suspect it's one of the ornamental pears that you were seeing.
And the new ones will be a different cultivar. The Bradford pears did a V-split in ice storms so noticeably that now there are a lot of cultivars. I can't tell you any of them, but Bradford's not sold anymore.
Yeah, Bradford's not the one to plant, but...
But it's the one sometimes you'll
see.
But
it's the one that might still be around in fairly large specimens.
And it is gorgeous in the spring, those white flowers. It really is pretty.
Very nice tree. Okay, my other question is advice. I have a flower bed on the north side of a building, and it really doesn't get hardly any sun at all. And I'm interested in knowing about maybe some a flowering shrub of some kind that would be hardy in the shade and that it would flower at some point during the growing season. It wouldn't really matter to me if it were spring or summer. But and fall color would be nice too, but is there something specific you can think of I should go look up for that deep shade?
The flowering is a little bit tricky. When you were thinking deep shade, I was thinking of the hollies and boxwood, but their flowers are not that noticeable.
No, I was thinking of ferns, so I was even further off the track.
I'll tell you what's there now is holly and some tiny little azaleas that, you know, seem like they're going to take forever, and some shade-loving perennials like Bleeding Heart and a Stilbe and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
Something like an oak leaf hydrangea will hang on in a fairly shady area. It probably won't flower real well there.
Yeah, you'll sacrifice
flower. It does have nice fall color.
Mm-hmm. And beautiful texture.
And it gets more size quicker than a little azalea or something.
The oak leaf hydrangea, isn't that the one that gets fairly tall, like a 6 foot?
Probably.
Yeah.
And it's got a beautiful, the bark peels back in the winter. It's really pretty, even when it's not in flower, or even in foliage. And the foliage is beautiful fall color,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, you know, it would be happier with a better exposure than that. But I think the one that I learned in plant materials class was on the north side of a building on campus. Mm-hmm. And it was still a pretty attractive plant, just didn't flower a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll definitely look that up because I hadn't thought about that one at all. Okay. Well, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Next, we talk with a listener on line 4 in Charleston. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I had some questions about, I wanted to put in some lavender beds. and I was wondering how lavender grows in this area and if they could recommend some varieties for me to plant. And I'm at work, so I'll hang up and listen off the air.
You have Mr. Lavender here on the radio.
Boy, did you hit the mother load.
Do you have a pen and pencil?
Lavender, in general, for the reasons that we talked about earlier, if you were listening, is not a tremendous crop for Illinois because with the winter sunshine, the winter wind, it takes a toll on it because it wants to be sort of evergreen, and it has to stand right out there in the weather and take that, and that's not really good. It's one of those things that would be better if it was just blanketed in snow and could hide. That being said, there are some that I've had come through several winters. The old standbys, Hidcoat and Munstead, do a pretty good job of coming through. Munstead for me has come through a little better than Hidcoat, although that could just be the situation that I had him in. True Munstead has a lighter, more lavender flower. Hidcoat has a darker purple flower. Some of the lavendins make it through okay here. Grosso is one. If you can find it, Marge Clark is one that was developed by a guy in Michigan. Has dark flowers, really long stems. If you're into crafting with it, that one works really well. It's come through very nicely for me. I've had 100% survival in the third or fourth year up in the Kankakee area. So that's theoretically, at least, that's a 5A versus a 5B zone. There are probably others. You can look through different catalogs and probably come up with 50, 75, 100 lavender cultivars. Probably best to start with some of the ones that we know are hardier and go from there. I've gotten lavendins like Provence to come through for a couple of years, but then it doesn't seem to hold up real well. But it all depends. If you want a pretty landscape plant, the Hidcoat and Munstead are lower growing, shorter stemmed flowers that the plant can it makes a lot of color, a lot of fragrance in the garden. If you actually want to cut them, then one of the lavendins would be better because they get really big flower heads and long stems on them. So if you're wanting to make wands and that sort of thing, it works better. Also, sandy soil would be better. We don't have a lot of that in central Illinois. Some people actually put a layer of white sand under them so that it reflects. The surface dries off, and then it reflects light back up into the canopy, because the humid summers can cause some foliage problems in the summer. They also seem to. I've seen them do really well along brick pathways where they get some reflected heat back up from that. It makes them think they're back in the Mediterranean where they came from.
And along a lighter sidewalk.
That's interesting.
Mine do really well. I've got some 15-year-old lavenders.
Well, there you go.
And I think they like the limestone that comes out.
They do like a fairly high pH, so have your soil test done and go to it. I discourage people from trying to do commercial production of lavender here, but I think in a garden situation we can have a lot of fun with it and not have to worry about making our livelihood with it or competing with places like California and the south of France that just blow us away in terms of production. But we can have fun with it. And
you really don't want to cut it back too much before winter. Keep a little bit of top growth. And mine looks great still, but I think it would stress it if you cut them back too much to harvest them right in November.
Right. I just cut off the flower stalks on mine late in the season, left all the foliage there. Some of them look a little surprised at what happened over Christmas, but it's best to just leave everything there, and then in the spring you go out and whatever's dead will be crisp by then. Take that off, look for new breaking buds, and usually you'll do fine. Occasionally one will die almost back to the ground, but it'll come back up and still flower that summer.
Yeah, don't cross it off your list until you are sure. If it's July and it hasn't come out, you can probably be sure. The other secret is trying it on all different sides of your house. I've got them north, south, east, west, and try to let them see where they're happiest. And I just love lavender. It's really pretty.
Speaking of lavender, thinking of lavender gets me thinking about Herb Day 2005.
Well, that's right. A good thought to have.
Right here.
When
right here.
Is Herb Day 2005?
Well, that's a good question, Diane. We actually moved it to
He's so glad you asked.
The standard date for Herb Day is the third Saturday in January. This year, we moved it to the fifth Saturday, partially because the third Saturday was back to the 15th, which gets to be pretty quick after the holidays, but mainly because my good friend Don Haney was available if we had it later in the month. He's tied up with the gift show in Atlanta earlier in January. So it's January 29th at the Holiday Inn in Urbana, 8 in the morning to 4:30 in the afternoon, and we've got a great program lined up.
It looks wonderful this year, as always.
Well,
really good this year.
We really try. Well, it's hard for any program that Don is on not to look good. He's just a magician. He was a floral designer for 25 years, so his mechanics and all of that is spectacular. At that point, he decided he'd become a personnel manager and not a floral designer. So he sold that business, took the money, invested it in a 200-acre property out in the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia, and has turned it into just the most magical herbal destination you can imagine.
Say his name again. Who is this?
Don Haney.
He is awesome. I've seen him speak. He's excellent.
He's been here in town, but not too much lately because of the conflict with the gift show.
Okay. Now, space is limited.
Space is limited.
And are there still some spaces left?
As of today's mail, we still have like 100 spots
really?
Available,
okay.
But they're coming in like 20 a day. And when the 250 slots are filled, we're going to have to disappoint people because we don't want to cram more people into the Holiday Inn than can have a good time. So if you're interested, respond quickly. Something mailed today or this week is probably still going to be okay, but as we get closer to the event, it becomes iffy.
Okay, and the number to call if you want more information is 217, that's the area code, 333-7738, 333-7738, and we'll mention it again later in the show, but we've got some more callers waiting for us, so let's talk with our next caller, line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about some Miscanthus sinensis, which it's on the north side of my backyard, and it's 4 or 5 feet tall. I think it's sinensis. So I use it for screening, and I would like to screen an area on the west side, but I know that it's more damp in that area, and I wonder if either one of you might have an idea of how this tall grass would do in damper conditions.
I think it would be okay, actually.
I've seen it kind of, I think it was one of the, not a cultivar, just the species kind of escaped along a ditch bank where it was growing pretty close to the water. I have a feeling that would be all right. My colleague Tom Voigt is probably listening to this, making noises because he knows better than I do. But generally speaking, the grasslands are periodically inundated, so most of the grasses developed with a tolerance for wet feet at least part of the year.
And if you wanted to, you could actually double dig that bed and make it more of a little raised area, and that would give it a little more height, and it would have an area that would then run off, into another area.
I really like that.
And you could put other wet-loving things than if you did find another little spot that
down at the base of the slope
there.
Yeah, and berming it up a little bit, will give you a little more height on the screen, which is not a bad thing.
Yes. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And did we say mulch it, too?
Oh,
I've always,
all right.
That would give it a little more height as well.
Although
the
mulch would accentuate the wetness.
If it's raised, though, that would probably be all right.
Once it's raised, it's good.
Yes.
Next, we talk with a listener in Martinsville, line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I came in a little late in this deal, but and you may have already talked about, we've got a Bradford pear. It's just basically budded out. I don't see any leaves yet. This warm weather has really made things hurry along. In fact, we've got 2 or 3 of them like that. What's going to happen when we get colder in the next few days? Will that tree die out, or will it just be burned back and terribly scalded?
if they're actually coming out and showing green again on the buds, they'll probably be real susceptible to getting burned off. If it's a nice, healthy tree, chances are it'll go ahead and make adventitious buds and come out and grow around that. I would expect it not to flower much or at all this year and to be set back, but probably to survive that.
I would think it would survive, but it may surprise it.
Yeah, it's definitely not a good thing to be thinking about growing now. Are the buds actually showing? You know, are they breaking and actually showing?
No, I don't see any green yet.
Okay.
Yeah, because the flower buds on Bradford pears are normally fairly large, and when the leaves fall off, it's kind of a surprise to see them there, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're leaping forward. Usually the dormancy on them is pretty strong early in the winter, and even if it warms up early in January like it is, that's usually not as damaging as if that happens in February after their chilling requirement has been met. So usually if we're going to have a warm spell, it's better to have it in January than late in February, because that late in February starts rushing things along, and then we get a time when it drops down to 10 or 5 in March, and that really raises cane with it. But right now it would be unusual for it to be, you know, ready to go.
Assuming you can believe the weather forecast, here we are with warm days now, a few cold days, then back up close to 50 where we're at for a few more days. And, well, it looks to me like it has to hurt them. But
yeah. It.
I never have seen anything this far along this time of year.
Yeah. Well, it's not good. It's not good. And if, in fact, they are softening up and swelling, then they're going to be real susceptible to any cold weather that we have later on. And
now, you said something just a few minutes ago, and I missed most of it, but why is it so hard to get Bradford pears anymore? It's a tree I like, and they're just difficult to find.
Because they tend to get real narrow branch angles, and then as the tree gets to be 10, 15 years old, they split out like crazy. And so they've developed cultivars of the ornamental pear that have better branch angles and better structure, so that because it's real disappointing to get one up to it's 15 years old and 25 feet tall and this beautiful specimen, and then to have a third of it or a half of it just split off one day.
Okay.
So it's a matter of structure and just from that standpoint, the other ornamental pears are probably just as attractive, but they stand up to wind and weather and don't split out.
If we leave the tree alone, don't top it, don't do a lot of trimming on it, how big a tree can this become, and how long a life will it normally have?
And it is a Bradford?
Yes.
Well, if you get an ice load or a snow load in 1 year, you know, at the same time, it could split it. And I've seen them at 15, 20 years where that happens. But, you know, if you don't have that happen, they could go longer. But it's really just that branch structure, and it's the combination of ice or snow or together. It'd be really bad.
Okay.
But I've seen them just split in two.
And they can get 30 feet or
yes,
or taller.
I would think, yeah.
Well, if they survive that.
Well, that's why we planted them, because we wanted shade just almost immediately.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Knowing that we're going to eventually have to replace them, but I had hopes we could get several years out of them. But
well, keep in mind, if you do replace it with a different ornamental pear cultivar, it still has a lot of the same good characteristics. But they found it was too late once everyone had planted them. They found that weakness, and so now they're bred so that they don't have that weak structure.
Okay, you're talking about the Cleveland pear then?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And there's quite a few other ones too, but Cleveland's the one I couldn't remember earlier.
Yeah, and you know, once it became obvious that the Bradford had this supreme wood weakness, they've worked pretty hard to try to find some other things that keep as much as possible with as few of the bad things as possible. I would suspect a Bradford pear or an ornamental pear would ultimately get probably as big as some of these old farmstead pear trees that are mm-hmm. that
they
are
would.
Pretty good sized.
Well, some of them do get big. We've got one at our farm that's 45 or 50 feet tall. Probably.
Right,
yes.
Right. We had
that's
one that
old tree too.
Had
mm-hmm.
one that my great grandpa planted at the farm where I grew up, and like you say, it was 45, 50 feet tall.
And it's probably 100 years old.
We'd get the extension ladder up in the top of that, and somebody on the ground with a fielder's mitt, and we'd be picking green pears and tossing them down. And, yeah, I said, I've gone and gotten nostalgic here, but yeah, that
That's tall, though.
It is. Yeah. It is, and I would be up on the top of the ladder and get that queasy feeling of being about high enough.
Yeah, and you're wondering, what in the world am I doing picking pears?
But they are so,
so
good.
Many pears.
Well, you know, a kefir pear picked green and ripened off the tree and then canned, you'll never eat another Bartlett in your life if you've had those done well.
Well, we throw pears in with cider when we have cider made. And make
oh,
it myself.
Sure.
And it's identical to apple cider for what it tastes and looks to me.
It's a little sweeter. Straight pear juice is almost too sweet for cider.
Yeah.
Pretty good stuff, though.
Yeah. We call it pear nectar.
There you are.
That raises the price structure on it.
Well, I'll let someone else come on. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks for the call this afternoon. And next, we talk with a listener in San Francisco, California, on line two.
Wow.
Yeah, hey, greetings. We got a nice sunny and cloudy day over here at the same time. You know, I used to be in St. Louis, and I remember I was brought up out there, and I remember that the Mississippi River actually created, I'm not sure if it would be called a microclimate, but it was St. Louis proper was considered a subtropical, even though if you go inland about 20 or 30, maybe even 50 miles, it was considered definitely not tropical. And so it... The idea that along the rivers keeps a little warmer atmosphere and a kind of a different growing climate. I'm interested in global warming and the whole idea of being able to constantly keep track of putting in new native plants. And I'm wondering if, for example, the Illinois River or some of the other rivers keep kind of microclimates as well, and as well as the Great Lakes, so that. Even though it's officially socked in with snow and winter, the idea of being able to put in additional plantings so that people can prepare for native plants. So, in other words, are there natives that can be put in now? You know, someone could go down to one of the supply stores, pick up a couple of pounds of some native plant seed, and put them in at this late date. Or if, for example, feeding them to birds, you know, mixing them in with your bird food so that these seeds get scattered throughout the whole region.
Well, this is a possibility in the bird seed, but I would be afraid they'd actually devour it, and it wouldn't, you know, I would still just broadcast it myself.
Well, sure, but, you know, even if they devour it, you know, there's what, as they say with, you know, for example, the dodo, I think there was a, you know, they actually wouldn't digest certain parts of the seed, but they would digest the outer coating so that it would break a seal, so to speak, so that certain seeds could reemerge. And I'm sure that that's probably true with certain types of seeds. And, you know, certain of these supply stores, you can buy a pound of seed, which might be 40 million seeds, and even if you had a loss of 80% or something like that, you would still be able to get out hundreds of thousands of plants. And if they got broadcast, you know, very effectively with the flights of birds and the depositing, so to speak, at random.
You know, that'd be a really good research project for someone in the wildlife area.
Yeah, because like you say, I realize that there are things, there are actually seeds that have a dormancy that's only satisfied by passing through the digestive system of a bird or some other animal.
Well, right, and you know, this is one of the things about global warming is it's, you know, for example, with you know, we out here in California are getting socked in with huge rains, and we're obviously going to have some erosion problems. And many of those native plants have got root systems that are, you know, out here in California, we've got native grasses that should have 40-foot roots and should be able to withstand erosive problems. But we've got a lot of eastern grasses that took hold when the cattle industry came out here. And so we've got to get those natives back so that the erosion doesn't predominate. So I'm just wondering with, you know, with the economy going bad, it would still be an opportunity for people in their free time to be helping develop the native plants and rebuild the ecosystem, you know, a lot of these properties are going to be foreclosed on, and they're going to be dormant for a number of years until all of the economy gets resolved. So it's going to be an opportunity for native plants to get reestablished. And if we were to look at the bad economy as an opportunity for the environment to get the ground go fallow, so to speak, with the economy, it's going to give us the opportunity to get some native plants reestablished and maybe prevent some of the flooding and problems of the global warming.
I would think people would want to take native plants and take care of their own space anywhere. But, you know, people don't really think about that. But, oh, in our area, big blue stem and little blue stem and all of these gorgeous grasses, they have a huge root system. You're so right. So I would think you would want to do that in your own area. Do it just a little bit of research. There's a lot of books on it now, pamphlets.
I met a woman several years ago who has a business where she helps people design areas like around creek beds and streams so that when the heavy rains come, that plant material is in place and can help absorb that water and not, you know, have that water just shooting down the stream.
Right. It's kind of the opposite of the old farmer's approach, which was to dredge it out straight and cut down anything that looked like a tree or anything else there that held up the flow of the water.
Yeah.
We've reversed our thinking on that.
Yeah. It makes it a natural filter. The water slows down. Mm-hmm. It seeps into the ground before it goes into all the lakes or streams or ponds.
Right.
So it really is valuable.
It captures the erosion before it shoots down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico.
So it could be way back from streams. I mean, it really starts quite a bit in. And it's, you know, lawns, people's lawns. And, you know, we've got a lot of grasses that are cut so short. But just think if we had grasses that some were short and then you had areas where they were taller. It's really, I think, very pretty, too. So he brought up some interesting ideas, but the native plants are very
useful. You have to be a little careful when you buy native plant seed mixes because very often they're not all that native or they're not all that native to your part of the country and some things can get out of control. Like you say, the eastern grasses in California.
They're native somewhere, but not where they are.
Native doesn't necessarily is not a qualifier that makes things good necessarily.
All you have to do is go to some local areas where they are growing the native plants. That would be the way to find out.
And there certainly are nurseries. There's one up in Minnesota that actually deals in specific micro ecotypes of things so that if you wanted an Illinois-type big blue stem or a northern Illinois big blue stem, they could give you the one that's ecologically correct for your area rather than just whichever one grows best for them, wherever they're growing the seed.
And chances are you could get on the internet and you could find groups who are interested in this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, there are the prairie plant folks in our community.
Grand Prairie Friends.
Mm-hmm. Grand Prairie Friends.
Red Buffalo, Red Bison.
Red Bison. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Peoria, line 4. Hi. We have a listener there? No? Okay. We have a few more minutes left in the program. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455.
Let's find out who else is on the Herb Day program.
I just happen to have a list here.
That's a good idea, Diane.
in addition to Don Haney, who's going to do one program where he takes you on a tour of Buffalo Springs Herb Farm, which it's five seasons of Buffalo Springs. He's also going to do an arrangement thing with Floratherapy, which is right in his wheelhouse. It'll be wonderful. But we also have Pat Crocker, who's written a number of books, does cooking demonstrations. She's from Ontario, Canada. She's going to come down. She's going to talk about cooking with the herbs of Morocco, titled Come With Me to the Casbah.
Ooh.
That's going to be great fun, and we're hoping that we can work with the chef and actually work a couple of those things into the lunch buffet at Herb Day, which always gets good reports. My good friend Jane Taylor from Michigan State, who was the person behind the development of the 4-H Children's Garden there at MSU, which is famous all over the world. She gets whisked all over to do consultations. Everybody wants to put in a children's garden that's anywhere near as good as that one. She's going to do a talk called Creating Magical Spaces, which is kind of about bringing children into the herb garden, which I think will be great. And then Jane Hawley Stevens from Wisconsin is going to do herbal first aid, remedies from the garden. She professionally crafts salves and ointments and lotions and things with herbs. She'll be talking about that. She'll also be set up in the retail area, so you can go in there and give some of these things a try. I had a friend whose dad had had radiation for throat cancer, and one of her salves was the only thing that gave him relief from the burns that he got from that. So I think it's a real solid program with lots of good aspects and some of my best herbal friends and
good variety, too.
Yeah. We try to keep it mixed up. So.
And it's coming up January 29th, and the space is limited in the lecture room. So if you want to go, you should register pronto. Information, more information, 333-7738, 333-7738, and the area code 217. Let's talk with another listener in Danville, line 4. Hi.
Good morning. I mean, good afternoon, rather. I have a useful resource for Illinois native plants, and it is the November 1997 issue of the Journal of the Illinois Native Plant Society. And they go through about 70-plus pages of the vascular flora of Illinois and then listing the introduced species in all caps and then in regular type all the ones that are native to Illinois, and I'm just constantly consulting that. Are you aware of that list?
Not specifically. I know there are some really good lists, really good publications about the native plants.
Well, I do understand that they are working now to update this, but I think this particular issue may well be sold out because they've had so many requests for the individual number.
And so, the name of the organization again is the Illinois
Native Plant Society.
Okay.
Their headquarters is here in Vermilion County.
They should publish that as a standalone.
Yeah.
Do they have a website or anything? Because that would be the ideal thing where they could update it as needed, and people could just drop in there and pick it up in a moment.
It's at Forest Glen Preserve, which is one of our county parks. And of course, I just keep this particular one, and I don't see them listing a website, but they do have one. And oh, wait a minute, email ilinps@aol.com.
Very good.
All right.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
Sounds like a great resource.
And we've got just a minute left. What should we wrap up with this afternoon?
Well, even though it may be too wet or too something to be outside, catalogs are the way to go.
Yeah.
Start planning your garden. Don't just haphazard buy everything in sight, but have an idea. So I think planning, well, a little haphazard, but I do like to plan my garden and have it figured out and order things and go into garden centers.
This gets me thinking again about Herb Day, because I saw a presentation you did one year at Herb Day where you talked about planning a garden and the things to think about in terms of the space, color, and dimensions. So you want to think about it as this three-dimensional living sculpture. That was a good presentation, Diane.
Oh, thank you. It's so fun.
Yeah, it's a good group of people. And if you like gardening, or if you're just getting started, it's a great thing to do to go to Herb Day, because the people are so excited about gardening. And you might find yourself sitting at lunch with somebody and you'll get some really great ideas, not only from the panelists, but from people who are...
If you're a big fan of Illinois Gardener, you can actually meet and greet Diane Nolan most years at Herb Day.
I'm planning this year too. So
okay,
but it's really, you don't have to be intimidated if you're a novice.
No,
It's really good information.
Yeah.
No, we plan it as a day of fun and some learning and just good fellowship.
Okay, and that's coming up January 29th at the Holiday Inn Hotel and Conference Center in Urbana. And if you need more information, 333-7738. I bet it fills up like that now.
We got 20 some registrations yesterday,
yeah.
and
okay.
My secretary is already anticipating having to disappoint people, and she doesn't like being the front person when that happens.
Well, so don't procrastinate if you want to go to Herb Day, 333-7738. Chuck, Diane, thanks so much for coming in, and maybe
could you
come back before the springtime and boost our spirits.
We know the way.
Okay, very good. Thanks so much. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Settlement prices should be in now from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Hey, Celeste, make sure that Chuck and Diane put me on the list of folks that need to go into Herb Day. I'll bring the TV cameras with me. We'll do something together. Send me an email, all right?
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Chuck. You're not Diane. You're Chuck.
No, I noticed.
Oh, did you? Oh, I thought your voice, maybe her voice changed a little later in life. Anyway, let's talk. I'll be headed to Herb Day on January the 29th, too, and I hope to see you there. Let's talk about what happened in Chicago, not in Urbana, at the Board of Trade for the day. Futures were sharply lower in the wheat pit. The corn pit was down, too, and the beans were off. Let's begin in the wheat, where there was kind of what they called a technical meltdown. I don't know whether you can call 6.25 cents a complete technical meltdown, but futures did move through some serious technical indicators today in the wheat pit, and they were following the beans down lower today. They were down 10 cents in the bean pit, by the way. We'll get to those numbers momentarily. March contract in the wheat, a settlement price today at 296. They were off 6.25 with a high at $3.50, a low at 292.25. And there's where a lot of that technical trend traded. Once you go through the $3 or any dollar area, things start to fall apart. May wheat futures, 307.5, the high, the low held at $3.25 a settlement price there, off 5.25 at 304. July futures, 315 the high, the low at 307, settlement price at 309.75. They were down 6.25. And September futures, 316.5 the high, the low at 315, settlement price at 316, a penny above the low, down 6.5 for the day. December wheat futures down 6 cents, 330.5 the high, the low at 324. Settlement price at 325.5. From the corn pit, now 201.75, the high, the low at $2.50. Settled 201, down 0.75 cents. May futures, 209.25 high, low at 208.25. Settlement price, 208.75. And they were off a penny for the day. July futures, 217, the high, the low at 215.75. Settled 216.25, off 1 cent for the day. September futures, in the corn pit, 224.25, the high, the low at $2.23.5. They were off a penny at 223.75 today. And the new crop, December, 233.75 high, low at 232.75. Settlement price at $2.33. They were off a penny. March contract at 240.75 high, low at 240.25. Settled 240.5, down 1. March oats from the Board of Trade, 156.5, the high, the low at 152. A settlement price there at 156.5, and they were down 0.25 cents for the day. May futures at 154.5 high, low at 150.5, settled at 154, down 0.75. From the soy complex, extending losses from yesterday, 535 was the high today in the nearby January contract. The low at $5.28 a bushel, settled 529.75. They were off 7.5. The March off 10.5 for the day, 533 the high, the low at 524.5. Settlement price at $5.25 a bushel. May futures in the bean pit, 539 the high, the low at 529.5. A settlement price at $5.30, down 11.25 from the floor at the Board of Trade. The trader's saying, not much news to trade on, and technically we're just going to move it lower for the day. July futures, 545.5, the high, the low at 536.5, a settlement price at 537.25, down 11 cents. We'll find out from Wayne Nelson if there's any more news from the Chicago Board of Trade on why these numbers started to go lower yesterday and again today. August contract in the bean pit now, $5.45 the high, the low at 539, settled 539.25, down 11.25. We'll talk to Wayne at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock Central. September futures, 539, they didn't trade today. Down 11, well, they only traded once. I don't have the highs and lows. 539 was down 11 for the day on the September as a settlement price. November beans, 555, the high, the low at 547, and a settlement price at 548 for the November. That's the new crop, and they were down 10 and 3 quarters for the day. January bean meal now, 159.50, the high, the low at 155, settlement price at 155.30. They were off $4.90. And the March bean meal off 5.40 today at 155.90 with a high of 160.30 and a low at 155.50. January bean oil, 19.98, the high, the low at 19.70, settled 19.86. They were off 8. That's 8 cents. And the March contract down 7 cents at 20.11, the high, the low at 19.83, settlement price there. Down 7 cents at $19.97 for the soybean oil. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, Todd, it looks like it was a higher day today for cattle, while lean hogs finished lower. January feeder cattle, the high today 104.85, the low 102.95, the settlement 104.77.5, that up 242. And a half. March 99.55, the high 97.50, the low 99.45, the settlement that up 290. April 98.45, the high 96.85, the low 98.30, the settlement that up 245. February live cattle, today's high $90.50, the low 89.25, the settlement 90.47.5, that finishing up 207 and a half. April 88.22.5, the high 87.10, the low 88 even, the settlement that up 172 and a half. February lean hog 77 even, the high 75.95, the low 76.50, the settlement that down 20. April 77.20, the high 76.50, the low 77.15, the settlement that down a nickel. May lean hog 75.60, the high 75.05, the low, the settlement 75.57.5, that finished up 12.5 cents. June lean hogs 78.10, the high 77.40, the low, the settlement 77.95, that finishing down 2.5. And February pork bellies, the high today 95.05, the low 94.27.5, finishing the day at 94.82.5. That up 25. The Dow is off 98 points at 10,631. The NASDAQ off 49.50 points at 2103. The S&P 500 down 15 points at 1187.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Dear Dr. Science, writes Mark Whitehead from South Portland, Maine, if a man is a liar and says, I am a liar, is he?
That depends on whether he's telling the truth or not. If he's lying when he says he's a liar, that makes him a truthful man. If he's telling the truth when he says he's a liar,